to Isaiah to start with. This is going to be beginning a walk of faith, and this is Abraham. And there's something that Brother Jimmy mentioned a couple of weeks ago. As a matter of fact, he preached on quite a little bit, and it sort of caught me and my thoughts, because it refers to actually the reasons why things happen like they happened to Abraham, and as well as to the children of Israel as they came out of Egypt, and actually all the things that happened there during all these plagues that were brought upon the Egyptians. It all has to do with blindness. And so I wanted to look into that particular part and how it fits into faith, because you see, if we don't know what we're doing, if we can't see where we're going, we're not likely to do what pleases God. And if we get all the wrong ideas, we're not going to please God either. We have to use faith. And if you're blind, we talk about we walk by faith, right? But you can't walk by faith and be blind at the same time, exactly. Anyway. And not only that, but when I was in college way back when, in finishing up an undergrad, well, I was doing undergraduate work at the time. It was a course in psychology, and it describes the brain and how it works and how we think and why we believe the way we do. All these things that went into these, actually another one was social psychology, I suppose, really the one I would want to refer to. Because that was there where, why do people believe like they do? And why is it that, how do we actually determine how we're going to live? And all this gets involved with the same thing, and I'll get into that as we go. So Isaiah, 4th chapter. And beginning with verse 1. And in that day, 7 women shall take hold of one man, saying, "We will eat our own bread and wear our own apparel. Only let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach. In that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for those that are escaped of Israel." And actually, as we go down further, he's actually, in some sense, he's pointing out to the coming time when after God was finished with Israel, that they were going to be, is going to get rid of a lot of the dross. And people were going to suffer. People were going to die because they were not willing to do what God said they should be doing. And he says, and that day 7 women shall take hold of one man. I actually remember this being preached on by, and the general thought on this particular is saying that, these are all people who have their own ideas how they want to serve God, but they want to do it their way rather than God's way. And, of course, this particular one of our ministers made a comment and says, these 7 women is everybody but us. And no. If 7 means complete, as he was trying to say in that all the others, then also includes us too. Perfect example. And since Brother Barber has already said these things to me in a way that it sort of really caught my attention, because it's something that I have believed for a period of time. Most Primitive Baptists, if you were to ask him, old line or progressive or what, if you were asked him what day of the week did Christ die, they would say Friday. But the Bible says the Bible says Thursday. And this was really, and let's actually look at it. It's been Well, the Catholic Church declared that he died on Friday, back in somewhere around 325, 326 A.D. And it's sort of been accepted doctrine ever since then. And that he rose on Easter. I mean, that was what they said. It wasn't the truth, but that's what they said. You see, but our people followed that because that's all they knew. And some of them would have. I remember one of our ministers, and I would consider him a fairly brilliant minister because he had a master's degree. So, you know, he knew that, for example, that Jesus said in the 12th chapter of Matthew, the 40th verse, it's that when the Pharisees asked him for a sign, he says, "No sign will be given thee except the sign of Jonas. For as Jonas was in the belly of the whale for 3 days and three nights, so must the Son of Man be in the heart of the earth for 3 days and three nights." And he was saying somehow, some way, that 3 day, 3 night period started while he was in Gethsemane. No. It wasn't. It started when they literally put his dead body in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. Well, anyway. Arimathea. There we go. I'll get this pronounced correctly, maybe. But that was on a Thursday. And then they look at the end of the 23rd chapter of Luke, and it says, it says right here, the Sabbath, you know, the sunset, and it says, and the Sabbath drew on. But what is that Sabbath? No, it's not. You see, well, first of all, you have to remember this one. Jesus died on the Passover, right? And it says in the 12th chapter of Exodus that this was the 14th day of the first month of the Jewish calendar. That was that. The 15th day, when the sun set, ending the 14th day, it begins the 15th day. The 15th day is, according to Leviticus, 23 to 25, lists all the feasts. And it mentions the 15th day of the first month as being the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. This was a night. And remember also that the Jewish day is different from ours. It started, for instance, Sunday started at sundown last night. So it goes from Saturday, sundown, to sundown. So actually, Passover went from Wednesday night, sunset Wednesday, sunset Thursday. And when the sun set on Thursday, it then became the 15th day of the month, a high holy day. Just as the Gospel of John describes it being a high Sabbath. It was a high holy day. That's why they couldn't do anything. These back-to-back Sabbaths was what really occurred that week. So the women who wanted to come and finish the burial process that Nicodemus and Joseph had not completed, they wanted to do it as soon as possible, but they were not free to do that until Sunday morning. And they went out early that morning to go do it. But anyway, when we're talking about seven women, so this is an example of all of us, if we're not careful, we'll think, well, okay, I think it's this way. But it's not, and we have heard it. I mean, these traditions can get you into trouble if you're not careful. If they're set in the proper thing, that's good. If they're not, then you've got problems. And from there, I want to go to, well, back up here a little bit. I'm going to go to Isaiah. That is Isaiah. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going to go to Proverbs. I've been there once before. First chapter of Proverbs, beginning with verse 20. Wisdom crieth without, she uttereth her voice in the streets, she crieth in the chief place of concourse, in the openings of the gates. In the city she uttereth her words, saying, how long, ye simple ones, will ye love simplicity? And the scorners delight in the scorning, and the fools hate knowledge. Turn you at my reproof, behold, I will pour out my spirit upon you, I will make known my words unto you. Because I have called, and ye refused, I have stretched out my hand, and no man regarded, but ye have set at naught all of my counsel, and would none of my reproof. I will also laugh at your calamity, I will mock when your fear cometh. When your fear cometh as desolation, and your destruction cometh as a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you. And I mentioned this, and I've mentioned this verse before. And I said this is part of our learning process, that God has provided all kinds of learning possibilities all around us if we pay attention to what's there. And he's saying there, we're not doing it. And if you look at, for instance, the time of Isaiah, Ahaz has been, this is right around the beginning of Hezekiah's reign as king. And his father, Ahaz, has been about as bad as Ahab had been in Israel, the kingdom of Israel and the northern tribes, in the past. Matter of fact, at one particular point, he had actually gone to Damascus, which the Assyrians had captured. They were already under Assyrian control. Israel was at the time. And when they had gone, he had gone to Damascus, and he's seen an altar there, and he said, oh, I like that. And so he sent, wrote down the exact description of how that altar was built. And he sent word to the priest there in Jerusalem, says, I want you to build an altar just like this, and put it beside the brazen altar, which was made during Solomon's reign, when they built the temple. And, you know, so this was the situation. They were not worshiping God. He was doing his own thing. But see, they wouldn't listen. They had the words. They wouldn't pay listen to them. And even though they had all these problems, they weren't paying attention to the fact God was using this to bring them back. Even though the Bible told them time after time after time, you need to obey my voice. That is without the Bible. And so, I mean, this is the thing, is if we don't listen, and this is the lesson here, if we don't listen to what God teaches us, then we have to face the consequences of it. And sometimes we're blind. But in terms of these things, I want to go jump around a little bit real quickly to the 28th chapter of Isaiah. And if you want to put this down, verse 9. I think that's where we'll start. Whom shall he teach knowledge, and whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Them that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breast. For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, there a little. For with stammering lips and another tongue will he speak to this people, to whom he said, this is a rest wherein ye may cause the weary to rest, and this is a refreshing, yet they would not hear. But the word of the Lord was unto them precept upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line. But the point I really want here is line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. And this is what we're supposed to do. We are to pay attention to what's going on around us. Now, this is not always an easy thing to do, to pay attention. Because the way God has made our brains is the fact that we have within us, and there's a reason for God doing this. He has it so that we develop a set of beliefs. See, if we don't have anything, if we don't have anything that we're paying attention to, and this is our foundation, then we won't, basically we're blind. You have to have them, but you have to use these things properly. This is the reason why the fathers should be, and mothers, should be teaching their children. Oh, it really says fathers, doesn't it, in Ephesians? Fathers, raise your children, then nurture in the admonition of the Lord. Also in the Old Testament, several different places, he says, teach your children why? When they come to you, for instance, when they came to, when Joshua had led the children to the banks of the Jordan River, and the priests had taken the Ark of the Covenant, and they had walked out into the water, and as soon as they got the feet wet, the water parted. I mean, the water came up. The waters that were flowing down just kept on going, and what was behind there stopped, which means it started backing up farther upstream, you know. And later it says, now, and they were told to take 12 stones, large stones, and put them right there where the priests were standing. So you have a thing. This is where we crossed. And the other 12 they were to take to where they're going to be, Gilgal, which is where they spent the night. Matter of fact, that was their place of, they just stayed in that particular area, and then they went out from there to fight all their battles over the next 7 years for the most part. And the thing was, it says, now when your children look at these stones, says, what do these things mean? You are to tell them exactly what it means. When they were, the Passover, every year, when they would engage their children in a Passover supper, when they asked why this, you were to tell them exactly why it was. See, to put, instill in them a belief system of what is real. But we have to be careful about making sure that it is the real. And examples of this, and I know Brother Jimmy has mentioned this several times, the Talmud. These were writings of intelligent men. And they were saying, well, now this is what it means. What the scripture, what does this mean? Okay, this is what it means. And they would write that down. It didn't always necessarily agree with that. That's what they thought it meant. But was it true? Sometimes they would think, and we find plenty of examples in the New Testament where Jesus says, you've heard it said of old times. You've heard Brother Jimmy say that many times. He said, but I say unto you, and as he rightly points out, the things that he were quoting there, the things that they had heard of old time, were traditions of the fathers. The Apostle Paul, as he was growing up, he was there in Jerusalem. And we don't really know he was there in Jerusalem during the time while Jesus was alive or not. We do know that he was staying with Gamaliel, and Gamaliel being one of the doctors of the law, one of the people who supposedly really knew what the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, what those things meant. And so he was teaching younger men, and Paul was one of those people. Saul of Tarsus had been known at the time. And so he was instilling him. And Paul was very zealous. Well, okay. Should I say Saul or Paul? The early guys were called Saul. Okay. Saul was very zealous in the traditions of the fathers because he was positive that this is exactly what was supposed to be. This is how everything's supposed to be done. And he found fault because every time Jesus said something that didn't sound the same as what was written down here. See, they were comparison. He had it hard. He was instilled with these strong beliefs. Now, when Jesus came along and says, now, that's not true. You've heard, okay, for instance, one thing I love, one of my favorite sayings, because people usually do it listen to what's written rather than what Jesus said. And it says, you've heard it said of old times, love your friends and hate your enemies. But I say unto you, love your enemies, do good unto them that abuse you and persecute you. You know, all these things it describes of all the things that people can do to us that are hard on us. It says, you treat those well. You do good. You pray for them. I mean, that's pretty strong when you talk praying for your enemies. That's pretty strong. But Paul, Saul wouldn't say, no. See, it didn't match up with what Gamaliel had said, so Gamaliel was right and everything else was wrong. But you see, the thing is, and this is how we are, because in life we learn things as we gradually grow up, right? Some of the things our parents have done. And sometimes we think they're, I hate to say this, but, you know, if we start looking back at our parents, we wonder, now why did they do that? You know, for instance, I remember that during the summer that they would take us to the library and there was a reading program there. And so we got to listen to someone read to us. But I also remember, and this was basically every night, that they had two stuffed chairs. They would sit next to each other. And they would each have their own Bible, and they would be reading in the Bible to themselves. And so I sort of had a later, after I learned a few more things, I went, well, no, they take us somewhere else, have somebody else read to us, but they're not. And so I found fault with them doing it that way. And I found so much fault, you know, that I actually got brought about and she wanted to do that. And I said, no. You know, I was following along. I messed up, brother. And the thing I really should have noticed, and here's the point. I'm going to talk about precept on precept, and a little here and a little there. Here is another lesson. Yes, they should have been reading to us. I mean, that's a given. They should have done that. But you see, I missed out on a very other important point. Remember I said they did it every day? Every day. I was 42 before I started reading the Bible. This was 1982. 1982 is when I started reading the Bible every day. And actually, I broke it down into sections. You know, I have a Bible, you know, a list. Every day, I've got a list, and it says, okay, today you read these scriptures. Sometimes if you want to look at it and you're thinking about this, the first three chapters of Genesis is about the length I read every day. And so in 11 months and one day, I go completely through the Bible. See, that was just, and it's one particular point, I'm not sure exactly where this came from, other than the fact that it was a summer after I graduated from high school, we were visiting a minister in northwest Nebraska, and we were eating a meal, and they have their own little practice that every day after lunch they read a chapter from the Bible. Just like we read, you know, in this program here. So it was, you know, and I remember very strange, another thing bothered my father, and that was the fact that he sort of put down, after we left there, he sort of put down there was some reason why you shouldn't be doing it that way. And that sort of bothered me, but, I mean, well, that's just the way it goes, you know? And as I've read through, I run across things like, and this is something that I'm going to get back to Abraham. What is happening to what we believe, and but always look at and see if what they're talking about is reality. You know, which one is closer to God, what we see or what we have been doing? That's the question. Because when you start walking by faith, you get to the place where you don't have that much knowledge. Now, the older we get and the more we learn, then we're less likely to run into that particular problem. But we still, it's important that we actually pay attention to what's going on. Now, the reason why I say that, I suppose, is because of my college training. I was in mathematics. And if you remember plane geometry, you know, you had to prove these things. You know, at least if you haven't had plane geometry, then you might not know that. But anyway, this was a school where we had the theorems and we had to prove all these things. And so in my graduate, my undergraduate works in mathematics, that's exactly what we had to do. We made all these statements about what the operating system, the number system is all about and all the characteristics it had. We had to prove that this all made sense. And so you had to prove it. And I know several times that I would say, okay, I had this brilliant proof. Everything looked just right. And I was up on the board doing that, and somebody said, what about? And they were right, and I was wrong. Blew the whole thing. So you see, you have to pay attention. Now let me get back to Abraham now. And back to, let's see where I want to go. Back to the 15th chapter, I think. No, 12th chapter, 18th verse. Because you see, and again, because Abraham, this is the earlier part of his, during the first 10 years of his walk with God, and his faith is just gradually building, and as we go through this, we'll see actually his faith building. And in the 18th verse here, we're in Egypt. And he has said to Sarai, as they approach Egypt, he says, now, when we get there, if somebody says anything, I want you to say that you're my sister, because they will kill me to get to you. And so you will do me a favor if you do it that way. Genesis chapter 12. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this that thou hast done to me? Why did thou not tell me that she was your wife? We don't know exactly what had transpired and how Pharaoh learned that Abram's wife was the one he said was his sister. But we do know that the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai's being part of his concubines. I mean, that's a bad thing to say. And he didn't like this thing, as I mentioned before. He didn't like this thing. But you see, what did he learn? Yeah, what? Because God had told Abram that I will bless those that bless you, I will curse those that curse you. Now, what does this mean? And this is a practical application of that. That God was protecting Abraham. God was protecting Sarai. Both of them. And that was something he didn't yet understand. So this is something he had to be learned from that. This is something he had to see and put that in with his other sin. Because God will protect us. But he hadn't got to that point yet. As far as that's concerned, what about Sarai? Remember, she was among his concubines for a period of time. It may have been months. The Bible doesn't say how long they were there in Egypt. But at any time, being there, she could have been called to Pharaoh and to Pharaoh's bedroom. That was the reality. And yet she wasn't. See, this is something for her to learn. That doesn't make any difference what kind of situation I wind up in, God's going to protect me. This is pointing that out. Now, whether she actually had learned anything, but there it was, right there in front of her. But you have to understand that when you have to understand, you have to have an internal belief that God is there with you. And sometimes it takes a few things like this where it says, yes, I'm here. And this will be obvious when I talk about the children of Israel coming out of Egypt this afternoon, because I'm going to do something similar to that here. And from there, we want to go to a couple chapters later. No, it's one chapter. 13th chapter, 8th verse. Abram said unto Lot, and they had just come back from Egypt. And again, I want to emphasize the fact that Pharaoh had expelled him out of his land for not telling him that Sarai was his wife. Don't tell me sister, tell me the truth. And this should have been something that Abram should have understood after it happened, that you don't do things like that. Did he learn it? Obviously, in 19th chapter says, no, he hadn't learned that lesson. And we'll be why later. And Abram said unto Lot, let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Now, this particular situation is the fact that they had come back, and Abram and Lot both had fairly large flocks, and they eat a lot of grass. And there wasn't enough grass, there wasn't enough water really to serve. And so their servants were beginning to fight over who was getting the right to the well, to the water. And this was the situation. And so Abraham says, no, let's not do it that way. We're brothers. You know, I'm uncle and nephew. We're brethren. We need to get along. And this is a good part of it. That's what God expects us to do. If we're going to love our neighbor as ourselves, then this is what you do. And see, God is putting those things in there. He says, is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. And if thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. If thou be apart from the right hand, I will go to the left. Then Lot shows what it means to follow taking knowledge from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What is good? What does it look like is good? Not necessarily what is right, what is good. Oh my goodness gracious, we're right, we don't have enough grass. And out there, looking out at the plain, I mean, you got all that water. I mean, there's plenty of water, there's plenty of grass there. I'll go there. Not bothering to check and see what is the situation there. And we know what happened. And it wasn't good. Now, we'll go to the 14th chapter, 18th verse. And this comes right after Lot had really got himself in a lot of trouble because there was a kingdom north of there somewhere that had invaded that area, actually had them under his control for a while, and then there was this rebellion, and so he's comes back in and basically takes everything, including Lot, destroys the armies and takes every type of spoil they could get their fingers on. And then when Abram hears of it, then he takes off with his 318 servants, and there was also a couple of his friends among the Amorites that lived in the area around Hebron, and who joined with them, and between the three or four of them, they had enough forces that they actually defeated all these kings. Now, my thinking is this, and that's the fact that they would not have succeeded if it hadn't been for God. I mean, 318, that's not a very big army. I'm sorry, folks, it's not. And to chase them for the distances they chased him is really something else. And when he comes back from there, he is met by the king of Salem, Melchizedek. And then read verse 8. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was a priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered thine enemies into thy hand." And he gave him tithes of all. Okay. See, here's God teaching something through, and surprisingly enough, you see, Abram wasn't the only person following God in the land of Canaan. I mean, here you have the king of Jerusalem, that's what Salem, referring to Jerusalem, the king of a city was the priest of the Most High God. So there were a group of people there which were serving God. It wasn't that way when Israel got back out of Egypt, but it was then. And to have him. And Melchizedek is a very special person. And David mentions something, and he probably didn't understand what he was writing when he was talking about here was someone, and Melchizedek was teaching him. Abraham was blessed. And to point out this very important lesson, another precept upon precept, here's another thing. They were on that battle. God provided for them. God enabled them all the spoil and all the people that had been taken. Bring them back. And so that was a lesson. God will protect you when you're doing what is right. But see, that was another thing to learn. Because going now to the 15th chapter, see, this fits in with what God says in the first verse of chapter 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. I am thy shield." He had been in battle not all that long ago. "I am thy shield. I will protect you." I mean, this is building upon it. So it's not a matter, well, it just happened this time. No, it'll happen every time. It happened when he was down in Egypt, although he didn't understand it at the time. "I was there protecting you." And even as it says, I think in the book of Psalms, it's speaking of the fact that that God would not allow anyone to harm them. Although, again, he did not necessarily understand it that well. You'll know how many children, how many prodigy will come from you. It's all up there. And then things are beginning. By this time, things are beginning to click. He now gets to the place where, "Yes, I believe you, God. I believe that you will provide exactly what you said, that you will reward me." And by the way, the verse in the book of 11th chapter of Hebrews that is, I think, is the fifth verse we want to write this down. Because it's talking about Noah and the fact that Noah pleased God, that by Noah, by faith, Noah did these things. and it was written of him that Noah pleased God. And it says, for without faith is it impossible to please God. For he that cometh unto God must believe that he is and is a rewarder of them who diligently seek him. All that faith is yes. Must be diligent. You can't just do willy-nilly. You've got to be diligent. And you have to believe he is. You also have to believe that he is a rewarder. He rewards you. Now remember this part about God. Yes, our works does have an effect on what God does. But even so, our best of works, and this is something that Paul wrote about when he was speaking about Abram, and he said that he had whereof to glory, but not before God. He had to glory against other men, because compared to other many people, he was doing much closer to what God expected than anybody else. But he couldn't, compared to God, he didn't have a candle. He just wouldn't hold a candlestick up to God, because he's not able to it. And this is where faith comes in. Believe. He believed God existed. Because he would build all these altars, he believed the things that he had been sold at this point, up to this point. He has finally got to the point where he understands a little bit more about God. Now, right afterwards, he said, verse 7 says, and he said unto him, I am the Lord that brought thee up out of the Ur of the Chaldees to give thee this land to inherit it. And he said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? See, back gouting some. He wants another sign. Sometimes he gets them, sometimes he doesn't. And sometimes we would like signs. Hey, Lord, show it to me. And then we don't pay attention to it. So he got the place with me. But we're going to find out rather quickly, because I'm going to the next chapter, 16th chapter. Remember, God said in the 15th chapter, you are going to father a child. You are going to have a child. You're going to have a son. Well, he's 85 at this point. Sarah is 75. Oh, really? I'm going to have a child? But you see, when he saw all those stars, he could see it. And again, I truly believe that in that vision, he actually literally started, maybe he didn't, but I would have. I'll be honest with you. If you have to be honest, that kind of, and then wonder as I start counting, did I catch this one over here? Because it's truly beyond imagining. Even though we know that literally there's only about 2,000 points of light, or what we call stars, in the sky. But still, when you start counting 2,000 all over the sky, you begin to wonder, wait a minute here. Did I miss one? But again, it says he believed, and it was counted to him for righteousness. See, this is what God requires of us in obeying his voice, is doing what he says. Why should we do what God says? It's very simple. God is all-knowing. He knows. He has all wisdom. He knows what is right. He knows what is best. So we need to do that. It's that simple. But we've got to come to the place where we admit he knows that. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, behold, now the Lord has restrained me from bearing. I pray thee, go in unto my maiden. It may be that I may obtain children by her. And Abram hearkened unto the voice of Sarai. See, she hadn't come to the same point. God was not ready to reveal some things to her that he would a little bit later. And so as a consequence, considering the fact that what, 75 years of age, she'd already gone through menopause decades ago. She couldn't have children. Well, according to Abram, we can say that this was Abram's idea when God told him to leave his family and his friends and whatever and go to the land he would show him. When that occurred, he thought that with how beautiful his wife was, that when he, again, like when he got there into Egypt, he said, you know, tell him you're my sister. I will say you're my sister and you agree with me. Tell him that because I don't see the fear of God in their eyes. I don't sense them having a fear of God. So they're not going to care. Yeah, God says do this, but they're not going to care. They want her, and it was a matter of attitude. If I want, I'll take. And he knew that. And that's what worried him. But he didn't understand what God was capable of doing. He learned over a period of time. And so, and again, as I mentioned Sarai earlier, the fact that she should have seen in her experiences there with the other concubines that she was being protected. Everybody else was being called. Everybody else was running into problems. Again, it didn't say what kind of plague, but it appeared to have affected all the other concubines. Or a bunch of them. And here's where we run into the problems with Sarai. When he says, go into my maid. See, did you notice one thing? And here's an important lesson. We need, when we run into a problem, if things aren't working right, we need to ask God. Is this what we should be doing? If he didn't understand, and that's one of the things about, I think people don't really understand God's interaction with Moses on the mountain the first time. I mean, he asked questions. I mean, he made simple statements that, if you actually stop and think of it, makes sense. He says, I'm a slow speech. I mean, he hasn't spoken Hebrew in 40 years. How is he supposed to, you know, suddenly pick up the language? God said, who made the mouth, right? Who made the tongue? God created a language. God, you know, created everything. So, he forgot about, but you see, he forgot about it. But they answered those questions. But then he got a little stubborn and says, send who you will send. And God got a little bit angry over that, and that was that. Anyway, so Sarai did not understand the power of God, put simply. Just like at times we don't understand his power like we should. And so they decide, okay. And again, this is an example. See, God says you're going to be a father. You have, again, back in the Garden of Eden, you got the tree of life, which is the ways of Christ, the ways of God, and then you have the tree of the knowledge of evil, which is the ways of whatever seems best. And this is the situation here. What seemed best? I can't have any children. This young lady, regular as can be, as far as her peers are concerned, I mean, she ought to be easily able to get pregnant, and I can have children by her. And not stepping out thinking about the consequences of it. And the consequences is going to cost her dearly for about 15 years. Because it didn't, you know, within a few months, yes, Hagar is pregnant. And now Hagar is thinking, you're the wife of my master, but I'm the one who's carrying his child. You know, see how, and because especially you have to remember the fact, at that time, and for probably centuries, both sides of it, a woman was not considered to, well, I'll put it this way, women who did, were not able to have children were looked down upon. I mean, they just weren't a normal woman. I put it that way. And as a result, here she was, and says, "You're nothing. I mean, I may have to do what you say, but you're not really anything." And so this is what she had thrown up in her face all the time. And even when she didn't have it thrown up in her face, I mean, and the looks that Hagar had towards her, there were still the things that she knew. And so this was day after day after day, year after year. Well, let's say day after day and month after month during the 9 months of pregnancy. In fact, in verse 5, it says, "And Sarai said unto Abram, My wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom. And when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee." See, I've done this for you, Abram. Now, look what a situation you brought upon us. I don't think I hear God in that very much, do you? Not really. But see, that's something here to spot. And here's another thought. Once the child was conceived, that child had to be taken care of. And in reality, it would be about 15 years. Because that's in reality what it is. Because the child was born. Well, before, let's not go that far. Anyway. So, Sarai now wants to know from Abram what he's going to do about the situation. And he says, "Behold, thy maid is in thy hand, do to her as it pleases thee." And when Sarai dealt heartily with her, she fled from her face. So this was Sarai's way of reminding Hagar, "I'm the boss." And she mistreated her, which is not exactly proper. And you see, and here's the Lord coming in from another direction. Because verse 7, "And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain on the way, in the way to Shur." And he said, "Hagar, Sarah," and he said, "Hagar, Satan, Sarai's maiden, whence camest thou, and whither wilt thou go?" And she said, "I flee from the face of my mistress." And the angel of the Lord said unto her, "Return to thy mistress, and submit thyself under her hands." And the angel of the Lord said unto her, "I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude." And the angel of the Lord said unto her, "Behold, thou art with child, and shall bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren." And she called the name of the Lord that called unto, is spake unto her, "Thou God seest me, for," she said, have I also here looked after him that seest me." Now, I'm not going to pronounce the name of that well in the next verse. However, I will say this much. This was when Isaac was about 40 years old. That he had separated himself from his father. He had his own flocks, you know, his own encampment at this well. At this very well. But anyway, so you see, the Lord is not only protecting Abram, not only protecting Sarai, he's now going to be protecting Hagar and Ishmael. He will not be. And he's consoling Hagar, telling her, now this is what you need to do. You need to submit yourself to her. After all, and that was in spite of the way that Sarai had treated her, you still are to submit yourself to her. I will take care of your son. You're going to have a son, and I will see he's taken care of. He's mine. Okay. Now, chapter 17. We now have gone from when Ishmael was born, which was while Abram was 86. This is 13 years after Ishmael's birth, which, if you follow Judaism just a little bit, you know this is their bar mitzvah, when they declare to be an adult. And when Abram was 90 years old and nine, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am the Almighty God, walk before me and be thou perfect, and I will make my covenant with thee between me and thee, and will multiply thee exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham, for a father of many nations have I made thee. And will make thee exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee. And I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and thy seed after thee in a generation, for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for everlasting possession, and I will be their God. And God said unto Abraham, thou shalt keep my covenant, therefore thou and thy seed after thee in their generations. This is my covenant which ye shall keep between me and you and thy seed after thee. Every man child among you shall be circumcised, and you shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant betwixt me and you. Okay, go down to verse 15. I'm going to skip a lot of these things because I want to get to a different type of list. And God said unto Abram, as for Sarai thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. And I will bless her and give thee a son also of her. Yea, I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings shall be of her. Then Abram fell upon his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old, and shall Sarah that is 90 years old bear? Is he questioning the power of God? But the point is, and there's a reason why the 99, because again, I mentioned that Ishmael is now 13. Now, we know from what occurs a little bit shortly after this that shortly after she had weaned Isaac, which at that particular time was probably sometimes two, sometimes up to, they would breastfeed up to 5 years. As a matter of fact, even in the present day, there are some places where women do this. How long exactly, I don't know. But the point is, Ishmael is getting to be a teenager. He's getting to a place where he could take care of himself. And there's bound to be some problem between Sarah and Hagar, or more particularly, actually, Ishmael. Because Ishmael represented something that wasn't Sarah's. This was Hagar's son. And so when Ishmael did something, I mean, he may make a funny face or something anyway. It looked like he was mocking Isaac, that all these years that Sarah had been suffering because of what she had, decisions she had made way back when, that she got to the place, she said finally, my son shall not be in the same camp as him. And she demanded that Abraham kick Hagar and Ishmael out. And Abraham didn't want to do that. He really didn't. But God intervened here and says, go ahead. It was time to separate the two. Ishmael would be taken care of, and he would have his area where God would provide for him. This is the area that you are to live in, and I will make sure everything goes well. And Isaac, and then later Jacob, all these would fit where they belong. And I think at this point we'll stop this.